Chapter 39. The International Catastrophe of 1914. First, the armed peace before the Great War. Second, Imperial Germany. Third, the spirit of imperialism in Britain and Ireland. Fourth, imperialism in France, Italy, and the Balkans. Fifth, Russia, a grand monarchy. Sixth, the United States and the imperial idea. Seventh, the immediate causes of the Great War. Eighth, a summary of the Great War up to 1917. Ninth, the Great War from the Russian collapse to the armistice. Tenth, the political, economical, and social disorganization caused by the war. 11th, President Wilson and the problems of Versailles. 12th, summary of the first covenant of the League of Nations. 13th, a general outline of the treaties of 1919 and 1920. First, for 36 years after the Treaty of San Stefano and the Berlin Conference, Europe maintained an uneasy peace within its borders. There was no war between any of the leading states during this period. They jostled, browbeat, and threatened one another, but they didn't come to actual hostilities. There was a general realization after 1871 that modern war was a much more serious thing than the professional warfare of the 18th century, an effort of peoples as a whole that might strain the social fabric very severely, an adventure not to be rashly embarked upon. The mechanical revolution was giving constantly more powerful and expensive weapons by land and sea, and more rapid methods of transport, and making it more and more impossible to carry on warfare without a complete dislocation of the economic life of the community. Even the foreign offices felt the fear of war. But though war was dreaded, as it had never been dreaded in the world before, nothing was done in the way of setting up a federal control to prevent human affairs drifting towards war. In 1898, it's true, the young Tsar, Nicholas II, from 1894 to 1917, issued a rescript inviting the other great powers to a conference of states seeking to make the great idea of universal peace triumph over the elements of trouble and discord. His rescript recalls the declaration of his predecessor, Alexander I, which gave its tone to the Holy Alliance, and it's vitiated by the same assumption that peace can be established between sovereign governments rather than by a broad appeal to the needs and rights of the one people of mankind. The lesson of the United States of America, which showed that there could be neither unity of action nor peace until the thought of the people of Virginia and the people of Massachusetts had been swept aside by the thought of the people of the United States, went entirely disregarded in the European attempts at pacification. Two conferences were held at The Hague in Holland, one in 1899 and another in 1907, and at the second, nearly all the sovereign states of the world were represented. They were represented diplomatically. There was no direction of the general intelligence of the world to their deliberations. The ordinary common man didn't even know that these conferences were sitting, and for the most part the assembled representatives haggled cunningly upon points of international law affecting war, leaving aside the abolition of war as a chimera. These Hague conferences did nothing to dispel the idea that international life is necessarily competitive. They accepted that idea. They did nothing to develop the consciousness of a world commonweal overriding sovereigns and foreign offices. The international lawyers and statesmen who attended these gatherings were as little disposed to hasten on a world commonweal on such a basis as were the Prussian statesmen of 1848 to welcome an all-German parliament, overriding the rights and policy of the King of Prussia. In America, a series of three Pan-American conferences in 1889, 1901, and 1906 went some way towards the development of a scheme of international arbitration for the whole American continent. The character and good faith of Nicholas II, who initiated these Hague gatherings, we won't discuss at any length here. He may have thought that time was on the side of Russia, but of the general unwillingness of the great powers to face the prospect of a merger of sovereign powers without which permanent peace projects are absurd, there can be no sort of doubt whatever. It was no cessation of international competition with its acute phase of war that they desired, but rather a cheapening of war, which was becoming too costly. Each wanted to economize the wastage of minor disputes and conflicts, and to establish international laws that would embarrass its more formidable opponents in wartime without incommoding itself. These were the practical ends they sought at the Hague Conference. It was a gathering they attended to please Nicholas II, just as the monarchs of Europe had subscribed to the evangelical propositions of the Holy Alliance to please Alexander I, and as they had attended it, they tried to make what they conceived to be some use of it. Second, the Peace of Frankfurt had left Germany Prussianized and united, the most formidable of all the great powers of Europe. France was humiliated and crippled. Her lapse into republicanism seemed likely to leave her without friends in any European court. Italy was as yet a mere stripling. Austria sank now rapidly to the position of a confederate in German policy. Russia was vast but undeveloped, and the British Empire was mighty only on the sea. Beyond Europe, the one power to be reckoned with, by Germany, was the United States of America, growing now into a great industrial nation, but with no army nor navy worth considering by European standards. The new Germany, which was embodied in the empire that had been created at Versailles, was a complex and astonishing mixture of the fresh intellectual and material forces of the world, with the narrowest political traditions of the European system. She was vigorously educational. She was by far the most educational state in the world. She made the educational pace for all her neighbors and rivals. In this time of reckoning for Germany, it may help the British reader to a balanced attitude to recall the educational stimulation for which his country has to thank first the German prince consort and then German competition. That mean jealousy of the educated common man on the part of the British ruling class, which no patriotic pride or generous impulse had ever sufficed to overcome, went down before a growing fear of German efficiency. And Germany took up the organization of scientific research and of the application of scientific method to industrial and social development with such a faith and energy as no other community had ever shown before. Throughout all this period of the armed peace, she was reaping and sowing afresh, and reaping again, the harvests, the unfailing harvests, of freely disseminated knowledge. She grew swiftly to become a great manufacturing and trading power. Her steel output outran the British. In 100 new fields of production and commerce, where intelligence and system was of more account than mere traders' cunning, in the manufacture of optical glass, of dyes, and of a multitude of chemical products, and in endless novel processes, she led the world. To the British manufacturer, who was accustomed to see inventions come into his works, he knew not whence nor why, begging to be adopted, this new German method of keeping and paying scientific men seemed abominably unfair. It was compelling fortune, he felt. It was packing the cards. It was encouraging a nasty class of intellectuals to interfere in the affairs of sound businessmen.